Over the past 75 years, more than 10,000 chemicals have entered our food supply, but the EU allows just 300 additives. At Thrive Market, we prioritize quality, banning over 1,000 ingredients found in conventional grocery stores. Our Healthy Swap scanner helps you find better versions of your pantry essentials without the junk, dyes, or fillers, and everything is delivered right to your doorstep. So shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health at thrivemarket.com/getstarted for 30% off your first order and a free $60 gift.
We are so excited to be joined by political scientist Norman Finkelstein, who is a prolific writer and the author of several books, including The Holocaust Industry and Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom.
And this is a very sobering interview with Norman, not just because we're in a really bleak time, but because Norman offers some really frank words for the state of the resistance. You know, there was a lot of hope that perhaps Israel would suffer a major strategic defeat. A lot of people really believe that it would after it went into Gaza. But Norman, after, you know, so many years of studying this conflict, has a different take and has a really sobering assessment of, you know, what this current moment means for the Palestinian cause, especially in the aftermath of the killing of Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah. Now, he also makes clear that he's not judging anyone. He's not offering any sort of sanctimonious point of view on any decisions by these various resistance groups, because it's very easy to judge when you're not living under occupation, when you're not up against this genocidal government that Israel is. But it is important to be as clear-eyed as we can and to recognize, as Norman talks about this interview, where maybe he got some things wrong. And I think this is a really enlightening and informative interview, as always, from a useful idiots fan favorite, someone who, Katie, both you and I have learned a lot from. So let's hear from Norman Finkelstein. Norman, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always my pleasure to be on with Katie and Aaron.
We're recording this in the 1 year anniversary week of October 7th. So let me just start with a general question. You know, your overall assessment of where things are right now.
I have to enter a caveat before I even begin, which is right now the center of gravity has moved to the battlefield, and I'm not a military expert, so it's very hard for me to assess the current situation. At the political level, it's been surprisingly quiescent. I can't remember a single instance where the Security Council has been so silent, or not so silent, has been totally silent. I mean, at this point, there would have been meetings, there would have been different draft resolutions being circulated. There would be so much activity in the Security Council. And so far, there's been total silence. So at the political level, it's been inactive. Netanyahu, he's, I suppose, an intelligent man. That's what everybody says. And I don't believe in disputing, quarreling with facts. But his main ability is in taking advantage of opportunities. He's a politician in the first place. He's a politician. And he knew, which is correct, that once you entered into the last months of the electoral cycle, all of the media would be focused on the election. Gaza, Lebanon, they would drop to, as it used to be called, below the fold of the paper, of the front page. And so he can get away with anything. So immediately as Kamala Harris got the nomination, if you look, you could see it's very clear. Immediately as that cycle began, the Kamala Harris cycle, Israel was committing a massacre every day. It was just bombing this refugee camp, bombing that school, because it knew it could get away with it. There would be virtually no coverage of it. Even now, let's say if you were to put on the screen the front page of the New York Times, top stories, the hurricane, then the Kamala Harris Trump, and then the third story, and Gaza and Lebanon is below the fold, as we used to call it, below the fold, and then below the top half of the paper. He knew that he would be insulated from any political pressures, he meaning Netanyahu, he would be insulated from any political pressures for the last couple of months of the electoral cycle. So politics has been absent. The college scene, I think probably students are regrouping and trying to figure out how to move forward after the draconian crackdown in spring, and now the implementation of all of these restrictions on free speech, which make a lively movement well nigh impossible. So on all the fronts, it's been, on the political front, there's been an absence of activity. And on the battlefield, it's very hard to assess. Gaza, as was indicated yesterday, many outlets, media outlets, humanitarian organizations. There was the one-year commemoration of what happened in Gaza. And I think the reasonable conclusion is that Gaza is no more. There's nothing left in Gaza. Right now, if you recall, at the very, very beginning, when Israel first gave the order, I'm talking about October, roughly around October 10th, 2023, when Israel gave the order for the people in the north to go south, and they drew the line, you remember? They drew the line. I said at the time, well, it's obvious what Israel is going to do. It's going to declare the northern sector a buffer zone and effectively annex, the northern part of Gaza. Now, it took a year, but that's actually what they're doing right now. The claim is, which I consider complete, nonsense, we're going to clear out Hamas and then we'll let the people back. No, they're not letting the people back. That's not going to happen. First of all, there's not going to be anything left to come back to. They will flatten the whole northern sector of Gaza. That's what they're saying, you know. There's no secret about that. And Lebanon, it looks pretty grim. I think there's no denying that Hezbollah was dealt a very big blow. What will happen? I don't know. I've been listening to all these military analyses, and whether Israel knocked out all of Hezbollah's long-range missiles, whether Israel can isolate the south of Lebanon from the Litani down and just bomb it relentlessly like it did Gaza, and everybody will be wiped out. I'm not a military person, so I don't know. I know that the party of God will fight to the last person, but it's not even clear whether that will be an option, because Syed Nasrallah's stature enabled him to carve out some political space vis-a-vis Iran. In other words, he doesn't just do what Iran says. He was able to assert an independence and autonomy. And now that's not going to be an option, assuming the person that replaced him is in his 20s or 30s, which is what Nasrallah was when he replaced his predecessor, when his predecessor was assassinated by Israel. If it's a young man, he can't stand up to the Iranian regime. And the Iranian regime it's going to be looking out for its own interests. And it may say, we're going to end all the resistance in exchange for a ceasefire. And then the Hezbollah won't have an option except to agree. So they've lost a lot of their autonomy, I believe. So all in all, it looks grim. What can I tell you? It's the only thing one can do. I had a very close friend, the West Bank, and when the first Intifada was defeated, I asked him, did anything good come of this? Meaning the civil revolt. Did anything positive come of it? And he said, because he was a real political person, he said, lessons learned. And it's the same thing here. One has to be very sober, analyzing the lessons learned. And I learned a lot from the past year. I made errors, significant errors in some cases, born of illusions. So trying to figure out the lessons learned.
I'm curious your analysis of Nasrallah's decision to intervene, the position he was put in by October 7th. It seems pretty widely accepted that Nasrallah did not have advanced knowledge of Hamas's operation. Can you talk about what you think compelled him to intervene and how he's tried to calibrate Hezbollah's role ever since, leading up to his murder, which we now know, it's been widely said that Nasrallah had agreed to a 21-day ceasefire with Israel, but he was still refusing to drop his insistence that a permanent ceasefire be linked to a ceasefire in Gaza. And according to one Israeli official who spoke to NBC News, that's what basically led Israel to decide to kill him.
In one of his early speeches, maybe the first or second after October 7th, he was very clear that they didn't know. And you could see, if you read between the lines, he was not happy that they had not been informed by Hamas of the decision to attack on October 7th. And at that point, what's called the axis of resistance would have lost all credibility if it did nothing. If you recall, in those first few weeks, everybody was saying, what is Hezbollah going to do? What is Hezbollah going to do? It was an expectation that in the midst of, at least at the beginning, it was a declared genocide. You know, they muted the language over time, but at the beginning, it was a declared genocide. And Palestine had always been formally a sacred cause for Iran, and as a personal cause for Nasrallah, Syed Nasrallah. He did an interview 30 years ago, and he was asked, I can't remember the exact question, but the response was, if and when I die, I want it to be for Palestine. It was for him a deeply entrenched conviction and commitment, both at a personal and a political level. He had to do something. On the other hand, as Nasrallah said in his last speech, he said Israel has the technological edge. And they're smart enough to know that, you know, around October 7th. So that was just another way of saying we're not ready for the great confrontation. And so he tried to carve out a middle path, namely lobbing rockets and missiles at northern Israel, not really causing all that much damage, apart from the population had to evacuate. About estimates are 50 to 60,000 people had to evacuate, but not a full-scale confrontation. And if you look back then, by far, by an immeasurable distance. The worst blows were being suffered in South Lebanon. You know, hundreds of people were killed in South Lebanon, including hundreds of Hezbollah fighters. And about, is it 200,000 or 100 to 200,000 Lebanese had to evacuate. Today, the Times showed the pictures of South Lebanon, and it looks like the moonscape. It looks like Gaza. Actually, it looks worse. So he didn't have options. He tried to carve out a path. But I said at the time, if you remember, I said at the time that when people were asking, what do you think is going to happen the day after? What do you think is going to happen the day after? I said, I think we're closer to the beginning than to the end, because I don't believe that Israel will give Hezbollah a pass. They're going to do something. Now, that was only partially correct, because it didn't, until the assassinations and then the walkie-talkie and pager undertaking, it didn't occur to me that they were going to use this occasion to wipe out Hezbollah.
You've said that you were wrong about Hezbollah, and I want to know if you could elaborate on what you mean by that.
Well, I'll begin with an anecdote, a germane anecdote. I remember discussing Hezbollah with Professor Chomsky, and he said, I don't believe it's a significant military threat to Israel. And I take seriously anything he says, but I was skeptical of that judgment, especially because they did get at minimum a draw in 2006. So it seemed like they had established their own deterrence capability against Israel. So I didn't agree with that judgment. What I didn't see, because I didn't know, was after 2006, Israel invested a large amount of resources to the showdown, to the final showdown. Hezbollah had that unique characteristic of being very ideological, but also it tapped into the mental resources of the Arab Muslim world. They are fundamentally the fact that every Arab Muslim is going to be a civil engineer, an electrical engineer. I know Arabs and Muslims very well. They're part of my life at this point. Everyone's going to be a civil engineer, an electrical engineer, or go into something like IT, okay? So you had this wedding, this melding of ideological conviction and technical know-how. And I believed that the ideological conviction was such that they could prevail, or at least equal Israel. What I didn't see, and I frankly have to admit it, and here's going to be a digression, and you'll forgive me, and you can stop me. So my best friend growing
Mark
up was
it was
Mark Cohn. And Mark Cohn was a surpassingly brilliant fellow, for sure. And and he eventually became the CTO, Chief Technology Officer, for Unisys, which is one of the large computer firms in Washington and very connected to the Defense Department. And he liked mental games. You know, when we were all out on our bicycles, he was in his room playing chess. He liked mental games. So Mark eventually became the head of the computer system in the Bush-Cheney White House. And he once said to me, he was trying to, I guess, justify what he was doing. He said, you know, Norman, they work very hard, meaning Bush, not Bush, but, you know, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and so forth. And in fact, it was true. They work very hard. If you read the stories about Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld stood at a lectern. He never sat at his desk. He stood at a lectern, and he used to give all the, write all these memos, and they called them Rumsfeld's snowflakes. He was always giving the memos, you know? And I didn't get that the other side has his ideological convictions, which are as fervent as Hezbollah's, except they had 1,000 times the resources, because it's the Pentagon, it's British intelligence, it's German intelligence, it's French intelligence, it's the whole quote-unquote Western world, which is invested in bringing down Hezbollah, and eventually Iran, of course. So it was unrealistic that they could withstand the force of a combined and compounded intelligence of all of these organizations. So I guess that's what Professor Chomsky was thinking at the back of his head. You know, how can a guerrilla movement win against the Pentagon in terms of intelligence, you know?
Not intelligence like smartness, obviously, but intelligence.
No. The intelligence community.
And especially also, if I can make a point, that if Israel's doctrine is to deliberately destroy civilian infrastructure as a way to deter its military adversaries, which, you know, Israel is doing right now in Gaza and also in Lebanon. And also if Israel is hesitant to fight a ground war, which it clearly is, and it has the advantage in the air, which it's perfectly content to continue pursuing. I wonder if that's also a factor that puts Hezbollah at a significant disadvantage, because Hezbollah has tried to target military sites throughout the course of its intervention.
Yeah, but the expectation was that if they do not relent in their rocket missile attacks, it prevents the Israelis, Mr. Netanyahu, from declaring victory. And so at some point they have to launch the ground invasion. And at that point, Hezbollah has all the advantages. It has the two main advantages of its home territory, so it knows every square inch of Lebanon. And it has the second, which is not a small advantage. They're ready to die. Right. Israelis don't want to die. Not one of those persons in the Israeli army is ready to die for the cause. They want to go to their nightclubs. They want to go on their trips abroad. Dying for a cause is not on their agenda. Whereas for Hezbollah, it is on the members of the Party of God. They're ready. They're prepared. And at this point, they probably want to, as I believe Nasrallah wanted to die at the end, because otherwise it makes no sense how he died. So that's a very big advantage. But that advantage may not come into play, because it's possible they'll do what they did in Gaza. You know, if you look at the figures for deaths in the Israeli army, it's less than one a day. The last figure they gave out was after October 7th. It was 349 Israeli soldiers killed in Gaza. That's in 365 days. It's less than one a day, because there are no battles in Gaza. This is all a myth. There's no war in Gaza. The moment the media reported each day the conflict under the sub-headline, it would be the main headline, and the sub-headline everywhere was the Israel-Hamas war, the Israel-Hamas war. The moment they got that sub-headline, Israel won the propaganda war. Because they were depicting it as a war. There was no war in Gaza. There are no battles in Gaza. You search your memory 365 days. Do you remember one day when a battle was reported? What they do is they just flatten everything in their path, pulverize it, and then they move in order to, you know, blow up. Not, they don't even go into the tunnels. They blow up the shafts of the tunnels. There was no war in Gaza. It's all a myth. That's why, you know, when you hear the talk, Israel says, we killed 18,000 fighters, Hamas terrorists. How would they know? How would they know who they killed? Gaza's Ministry of Health doesn't know, because Hamas doesn't wear uniforms. They don't carry around IDs saying Hamas terrorist. So the Ministry of Health hasn't a clue whether this young male in front of them is Hamas or just was a young male who was walking in the street or in a building. So how would Israel know? It never actually fights Hamas militants. It may see some dead bodies on the ground, but it doesn't have a clue whether it's a militant. Every time you see the Israeli figures, I could predict every figure Israel will produce from now till next year. You know how you know how many are produced? How many, what numbers they'll use? It's very simple. The Ministry of Health releases as total deaths, let's say now they're saying 42,000, right? So Israel's going to say, we killed 21,000 Hamas terrorists. They want to show the 1-to-1 ratio to prove they're the most moral army in the world, because other places it's 3-to-1 or 4-to-1, but here it's 1-to-1. So all they do is take the total number killed, divide it in half, and say that's the number of militants we killed, or terrorists that we killed. They don't have a clue. There's no fighting going on in Gaza. It's a genocide. I don't care about the technical term, you know, a legal term. That's for the International Court of Justice to adjudicate, and law is its own discipline, and how they define genocide is not always the same as the way a layperson or Oxford English Dictionary defines genocide. But I'll just, if you'll allow me, since I've been writing about this subject, So Oxford's dictionary defines genocide as the murder of a large number of people from a particular nation or ethnic group with the aim of destroying that nation or group. And by that definition, you know, that's what's happening in Gaza. The war is just, it's secondary. You know, obviously, if you want to commit a genocide, you want to take out the enemy forces, because they're an obstacle to achieving your goal. But defeating Hamas is simply a means to an end. The end is to solve the Gaza question. You know, and it's people think this is just a terminological issue, but it's not. It's a question of trying to capture reality. What word captures the reality? If you take Raoul Hilberg's magnum opus, it's called The Destruction of the European Jews. It's not called The War Against the European Jews. Now, there was a book by Lucy Dawidowicz, she was a complete idiot, called The War Against the Jews, about the Nazi, because she didn't understand what it was. I remember my mother, whenever she would hear mention of a war against the Jews, what are you talking about? It wasn't a war. It was an extermination. She said we were cockroaches. They would shine the light on us, and we would scurry to this side. Then they would shine the light here, we'd scurry to this side. We were cockroaches. They were exterminating us. And of course, that image and the appropriateness of that image, because my mother had sensitivity to language, even though English was her several languages, but she knew Latin and she knew the roots and she understood language. that came to mind for me because you see the Gazans scurrying here, scurrying there. Go to the north, go to the south, go to Massawi. Go. Always scurrying. It's an extermination. And wherever they go, they get bombed. It's an extermination. It has nothing to do with war. So, as I said, the moment it became classified as the Israel-Hamas war, Israel won 90% of the propaganda battle. The only ones who understood what was happening were, of course, the South Africans. They went to the ICJ to say, this is a genocide. It's not a war. And if you read their application, they never use language like a disproportionate attack. They don't use language like disproportionate. They don't use language like even indiscriminate. They use the language, they're targeting the civilians. Do you know what a disproportionate attack means? It means you have a military target and you cause what's called excessive damage to civilians and civilian infrastructure. So let's say you want to attack Nasrallah. You want to kill Nasrallah. Does that justify killing 300 civilians or is it disproportionate? But a disproportionate attack presumes you are targeting a military site or combatants. But that's not what's been happening in Gaza. They're not attacking military targets. If they hit a military target, it's just by accident. It's a statistical error if they hit. It's the equivalent of a statistical error.
If it's military, Norman, you can't even define it as conventional military because Gaza's not a state. It doesn't have a standing army. There's Hamas as a militia with some weapons, but nothing that any functional army would have. So even the term military is not even appropriate.
The combat with guerrilla armies is obviously not something new. And guerrilla armies under international humanitarian law, they're also bound by the laws of war. So it's obviously a very unequal war, but I would still say if it's a guerrilla army, you can say the laws of war apply. But this is not a war, it's a genocide. I was on with this guy, Richard Kemp. Aaron might know him. Do you know him, Katie?
The British guy?
Yes, he's Israel's main military apologist. And I was on with him on Piers Morgan a couple of days ago. It was a complete disaster, but that's a separate issue. I made the point. I said, look, yesterday I read this letter from 65 physicians from around the world. They're not from God. 65 physicians who gave testimony as to what they observed. And every one of the physicians, all 65, testified that The children who were coming into the hospital, they had bullet wounds to the skull or to the chest. No shrapnel. It wasn't, bombs and shrapnel. It was targeted bullet wounds to the skull and to the chest of children. What does that have to do with war? They're targeting children. Snipers are targeting children. There's the convent. I've been reading the Navi Pillay UN report on Gaza. And they describe the convent. So there are two women in the convent. They're rushing to go to the bathroom. The snipers killed. They knew they were who the women were because the church, the Catholic Church, had sent all the coordinates and all the information to Israeli officials. They knew who they were killing. They then fired two tank shells at a school for disabled children. There were 54 disabled children who used school in the convent complex. They fired two tank shells at it. What does that have to do with a war?
Given the fact that basically I think what we're saying is that Israel is willing to kill for an idea or for material benefit, and Hezbollah and Hamas are willing to die for survival, let's say, what they see as survival, does that make armed resistance pointless?
I'm not a military man, and I feel very uncomfortable from the safety of my home and the fact that I had the opportunity to live a long life, to advise or counsel others to sacrifice themselves and not and have their life terminated when I was in college. I don't feel at ease. One of the things about the great, you know, my tradition, the revolutionary tradition, and also with people like Nasrallah, it was clear that death, the prospect of death, was not in their mental equation. That came with the turf, that you're going to die, or there's a high probability that you're going to die. But they never talk about it. It's like it comes with being that. So they never, when the 1905 revolution breaks out in Russia, okay? That's not the 1917, the pre 1905. Rosa, she's a young woman at that point.
Rosa Luxemburg.
Rosa Luxemburg, excuse me. She has a physical disability. She goes right into the revolution. And people say to her, Rosa, don't go, don't go. It's dangerous there. And it was dangerous there, you know. That never deterred her. She said, it's a revolution. That's what I've lived for. I've lived to see that day. So of course she goes. So they all expected to die. So when they tell others to fight, it's not hypocritical, you know. In my opinion, you know, pure speculation. When all of...
If you asked our critics, they'd tell you that Useful Idiots is a secret agent podcast funded by foreign governments. But you listen to Useful Idiots. You know we're American made. And at a time when it feels like most of our money is being sent overseas to fund weapons dealers, we want to show some support for a company that's doing their best to give good jobs to American workers and really good clothes too. It's American Giant. And since 2011, they've been making high quality, long lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic Full Zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate magazine. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. Check out the premium Slub Crew Tee, the No BS high-rise pant, and the slim roughneck pant featured in Giant magazine. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes, and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. Code USEFUL.
Syed Nasrallah's colleagues, comrades, had been assassinated. Because all the whole senior tier who he had been with for 30 years, he felt there was something morally wrong that he was still alive. He should die too. And he went to his death. So when you ask me that question, I feel uncomfortable from the safety and ease of my apartment in Brooklyn to be counseling on that question. What I would say is I can't fault those who elect to resist with arms if they've exhausted all other possibilities. One of the things I came to really respect about Professor Chomsky was he very, very, very rarely counseled war. He would always say every other option has to be exhausted before you resort to armed resistance. Because I think two things. Number one, it's too easy to be a general by remote control. And number two, because of his whole philosophical training, he came to attach a huge value to this thing called human life. And that you don't carelessly and cavalierly destroy life. It's the absolute value. So I will not, if all options have been exhausted, I will not say, no, you can't do it. But on the other hand, I'm not counseling anyone and, you know, long live armed struggle, which is what I was as a kid. You know, in my day, I was a Maoist. And one of the two things to make you a Maoist were you have to believe in the dictator. I know it's going to sound completely insane, and fair enough, it is. You had to support the dictatorship of the proletariat, and you had to support armed struggle. That you couldn't peacefully transition to socialism. You had to, it was inevitable that there would be an armed showdown. So I passed through that phase, and now I'm much more cautious, reserved before I counsel others.
And just to clarify, it wasn't a moral question. It was a strategic one.
Yeah, look, that was another, something I had to learn, okay? In our own history, American history, there were many slave rebellions. Not many, but there were slave rebellions. But those slave rebellions could not have destroyed a system so deeply entrenched as slavery. They couldn't. It required the power of a state, the United States, and it required a civil war that cost 700,000 lives to even begin to extirpate the roots of slavery. It took another 100 years to root out the deeper manifestations of that system of slavery. It took Reconstruction, and then it took the Civil Rights Movement. So I say this because what Hamas did was completely unrealistic. I don't fault them any more than I fault Nat Turner or John Brown, but it was unrealistic. Israel is, and I know it sounds like a cliche and I loathe cliches, but it's the entrenched, concentrated manifestation of Western imperialism. It's this, you know, very concentrated, intense manifestation. It's got deep roots. It's got the whole Western system behind it, that Western system which won't let go. It won't let go. It will nuke China before it lets go of its global dominance. And in order to defeat it, it requires a very long-term struggle and intense calculation. You can't do it by a throw of the dice. Hamas's approach was, we'll do it and see what happens. You know, it was a throw of the dice. We'll just see, you know, the famous line but associated with Napoleon, on s'engage, puis on voit. You jump in and we'll see what happens, you know. But you can't uproot a system like that, because it's not just Israel, it's the whole Western. It's the whole legacy of Western colonialism and Western imperialism is now manifest in that so-called state. And you just can't do it by a throw of the dice. And I didn't really see that. I thought, okay, it's going to set in motion all sorts of, like a pinball machine, it's going to set in motion all sorts of things here, there, and who knows what's going to happen. Well, you know what? We knew, we should have known what's going to happen. You can't defeat them by a random act, a throw of the dice. It requires a lot more calculation, concentration, real focus on how you achieve this goal. I didn't see that. I was wrong. You can't defeat a system like that by a random throw of the dice any more than Nat Turner could have brought down slavery with 80 other people thinking, well, maybe there'll be an uprising. No, you can't do it that way. I'm not faulting him, obviously, but it's what the folks in Gaza did was basically what Nat Turner did or what John Brown did. Now, you can say it was, you can mark it as a milestone to the final victory, which was the abolition of slavery, but it's not the same thing as what was required to uproot the system.
Especially if you don't coordinate with your allies, and including, you know, the ones that can do the most damage to Israel, like Hezbollah.
Hamas did what Nat Turner did. He just assumed that if they go on this rampage, that the slaves will rise up. He didn't tell anybody. He just assumed it would happen. And so did John Brown. He thought the same thing. But that's not how you win. It requires a lot more preparation, calculation. You know, at some point, yeah, you have to take the plunge and see what happens, but not before you've done a lot of preparation and calculation. And like you said, he didn't even tell them.
Yeah. Norman, I wanted to get your reaction to something Netanyahu said this week. He basically threatened a new scorched earth campaign in Lebanon, similar to Gaza. He said to the people of Lebanon in a message recorded in English, he said, "You have an opportunity to save Lebanon before it falls into the abyss of a long war that will lead to destruction and suffering like we see in Gaza."
You have an opportunity to save Lebanon before it falls into the abyss of a long war that will lead to destruction and suffering like we see in Gaza. It doesn't have to be that way.
What did you make of this statement? Is he basically asking the people of Lebanon to rise up against Hezbollah, and if they don't, he's going to turn Lebanon into Gaza?
Yeah, and that's their strategy, to try to turn the population against Hezbollah. It didn't work in 2006 during the 33 or 34 days, I can't remember now, during the 33 or 34 day war, the population of Lebanon, the support for Hezbollah soared to about 80%. Now it might be different. Now remember, in 2006, Israel caused enormous, it bombed every bridge in Lebanon. I mean, it was really brutal, but nothing on the level now. You know, I'll tell you an interesting thing. I was speaking in Florida a few months ago, and there was a young woman from Gaza who was on a Fulbright, and she actually got out to go to Florida. And she made she was probably 20 years old, and she made a very interesting observation. She says, "I always know how a new war is going to begin. It's where they left off in the last war. So Israel reaches this threshold in the last war, and then the new war begins where that threshold that was crossed at the end of the war." So at the end of, let's say, Operation Pillar of Defense 2012, Israel ends by targeting the high rise, what are called the historic buildings in Gaza. She says, in the next war, they start by targeting the high rise. So I make this point because Israel began the new round in Lebanon at the threshold it had reached, it had crossed in 2006. So it was total decimation. There was no reserve. And there were two factors. Well, there were basically two factors. Factor number one, Lebanon was already suffering before the current situation because the economy had collapsed. Their currency lost 98% of its value. So already the people in Lebanon were hurting before the Israeli attack. So there was that problem, and there is the intensity, and the intensity may turn the population against Hezbollah. So they may succeed in their goal of turning the population against Hezbollah.
Speaking of Hezbollah, I know that you spent time with them, and you also spent time with Hamas.
Not significant time. I want to be clear about, not that I'm afraid, like I'm going to get arrested, but I want to stick faithfully to the facts. On one day,
a tour,
I think in 2007, they took me on a tour of the South.
Well, I wanted to know what, from that experience, you learned that you didn't know before your tour. And also, a parallel question is what you learned from your time with Hamas that you didn't know before that, and how it shapes your view of what's happening now.
I guess from Hezbollah, the main thing I took away, which I think I was wrong, was the high level of competence and dedication, commitment. You know, I remember they had a translator. Do any of you know much about simultaneous translating? Okay, it's an art, you know, it's an art. And I remember when I was in Germany, when my book on the Holocaust industry came out, they had the best translators, the German translators. And the way they do it is you're talking, they'll put a word here, then down the page, a word here, and down the page, a word here. And then their mind is trained to fill in all the words between. So you could a word here, like the. And then 20 words later is the word good. And then 20 words later. And they're trained to fill in all the words between the two words they put down. And I was kind of mesmerized as I was watching these German translators. And then when I was in Lebanon and there was a translator and he was doing the same thing, and I said, these guys are pretty, they're on the top, on top of their craft. And then there was the conviction. It was the absolute readiness. It wasn't even, as I said, when I was talking about the revolutionary tradition, it wasn't even a factor in their thinking. Of course, we're willing to die for this cause. And they showed me what they had built. Like there was a very high mountain in Lebanon, and deep in the ground was their headquarters. And they said to me, now I'm no military expert, but they said this could withstand an atomic bomb. And that's why I was so surprised when they said they killed Nasrallah. I said, that's ridiculous. Nasrallah will have been in the mountain. Why was he going into the Dahiyah where Israel was bombing it every day? It didn't occur to me initially that he wanted to die. Because they certainly had places which were seemingly impregnable, unless you use, even to bunker busters, it was seemingly impregnable. As for Hamas, I have to be careful here because you have to distinguish between professional competence and political competence. My dear friend Sana Qasem, she handles my social media, and she's Palestinian. She's a brilliant chemist, lives in Greece. When I spoke disparagingly of Dr. Antisi, who was the head of Hamas when I met him in, I think, 2002, she said, Norman, Dr. Antisi was a distinguished pediatrician, and he graduated first in his class in pediatrics. He was a very impressive guy. And so I have to respect that their professional achievements might be very impressive. You know, you take Bassem Naim, who's the official spokesperson for Hamas now. Do you guys know him?
Yeah, I interviewed him in during the Sheikh Jarrah uprising, so, back in May 2021. Yeah,
I've been in I used to be, not lately. I was in correspondence with Bassem Naim. He has two PhDs from Germany. You know, two PhDs from Germany is not small change. But my impression has been that politically, if you've lived in this crushingly claustrophobic environment for so long, Dr. Rentisi had been in an Israeli jail for 10 years.
Sinwar
was in jail for 22 years.
Yeah.
And you go from this claustrophobic world of a jail cell to the not much less claustrophobic world of Gaza. It's hard to have a broad vision of the world. It's hard to see the world politically in its fullness. It tends to constrict your mental, political, and moral vision. And I think Sinwar is completely fluent in Hebrew, and he apparently is a smart guy, but I think he had, Nat Turner was a very smart guy. Everybody said it, whites, blacks, they said, Nat's a smart guy, no question about it. But the world is so constricted if you're a slave or you're a prisoner or in Gaza, that it's hard to have the broadness of vision that's required to defeat not just Israel, not even just the United States and Israel, but the entire Western world, which will not relinquish power. It will not. It won't allow for the transition from the center of gravity of the world shifting from the West to the East. It will not let go. So in order to prevail over that, it requires a capacious worldview. I don't think the people in Hamas, even though, as I said, professionally, you know, when I saw Bassem Naim, oh, two PhDs from Germany, not bad. But then you can judge for yourself, you know. You, both of you, you saw Hamas's statement after October 7th. You remember when they released that statement describing what they did and why they did it? You remember it was like 10 pages or something. You cannot call that an effective statement. They weren't able to rise to the occasion. I was in touch with, I don't think he'll mind. I was in correspondence. Well, look, he was in correspondence with old journalists. So I was in correspondence with Bassem Naim. And I said to him, don't bother denying what happened October 7th. You're not going to convince anyone. You might want to explain it, but denying it is not going to work. You can deny this, that, or the other.
You mean in terms of killing civilians killed? Yeah. On camera, you know, yeah.
Yeah, on their cameras. Yeah. On their cameras. you know, you could say, obviously, as you know, to the point of tedium, the claim about the rapes was false. And you could see it was very striking in the Hamas statements. They were much less indignant about the question of killing civilians than the question of rapes. Yes, it was the rape accusation that really outraged them. They didn't try very hard to deny the targeting of civilians. But the rape thing, because they knew that was a flat-out lie.
The only nuance there is to what extent were the killings of civilians committed by members of Hamas or maybe other people who broke out, you know, that there is a distinction there. But
I think that's – there are all sorts of – delineations, and I'm not going to deny that, but the broad picture is pretty clear. The broad picture is pretty clear, and it's pointless to deny it. What you try to do is explain it, which is at least what I tried to do after October 7th, explain why this happened, but not to deny it. So I was in communication with Bassem Naim, and he's obviously a very smart guy. But when it came to politics, or even a subgroup of a subcategory of politics, namely propaganda, how do you talk to the public? Very weak, very weak.
Well, and I want to tie in two people who you've already mentioned. I think this is germane to this topic, and then we can wrap soon because we've kept you over time. But you know, we've talked about in this interview both Chomsky and Nasrallah, and I know that they met. And I've heard you say that you think actually Nasrallah took some of Chomsky's advice.
Totally. It was very striking to me. Well, you know, Professor Chomsky is very persuasive, obviously. And Nasrallah respected the life of the mind, and he knew he was in front of a formidable intellect. And furthermore, Nasrallah understood that Chomsky knows more about how the West works than he does, you know? And so it was clear, if you listen to Nasrallah's speeches after he met with Professor Chomsky, he completely diminished the role of Israel in everything that's happening in the Middle East and attributed everything to the United States. He would say, Israel's just a pawn of the United States. Israel's just used by the United States. It's all the United States. That was vintage Chomsky. I thought to myself, okay, he persuaded him. You know, Chomsky is always very emphatic about that. That all the evil emanates from here. Israel plays a subordinate role, relatively very limited autonomy in what it can or can't do. To the point, sometimes I think Professor Chomsky underestimated the role of things like the Israel lobby and that sort of stuff. He thought that everything Israel did was just serving U.S. strategic interests. But it was clear. I remember I asked Professor Chomsky many times about his meeting with Syed Nasrallah. And my memory is, now there are two people who were with him, and you might want to interview them, Irene Genger and Asaf Khoury. They both went with Chomsky to meet Nasrallah. So you can want to hear their impressions. Actually, they wrote a little book, Asaf Khoury with Chomsky on their trip to Lebanon when they met with Nasrallah. But remember, Professor Chomsky says he barely said a word. All he did was ask questions.
Nasrallah barely said a word,
He just asked questions. You know, because he didn't want to make, he's like Chomsky. He's like Lenin. I'm not here for small talk. I remember when Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher, and also Russell basically was the Chomsky figure of the first half of the 20th century. And Russell meets Lenin, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, and Lenin had no time for him. I'm not making, making small talk. And Bertrand Russell described Lenin. He said, I've never met a person in my life who's so totally devoid of any ego. He was just a theory embodied. Mm. He revolution. And that's the same way, you know, with Nasrallah. I have Noam Chomsky here. I'm going to get everything I can out of him, as much information as I can. And it turned out he was utterly persuaded.
It's funny. I did a live show with Abby Martin and Rhonda Kalik, and we showed a clip of Nasrallah, and I had no idea he met with Chomsky. But after hearing him talk about like Israel and the United States and the head of the snake and imperialism, I joked. I was like, he sounds like a combination of Noam Chomsky and Jewish Voice for Peace.
Yeah. Well, definitely the first. Definitely the first.
Well, you're talking about Zionism also in a way that reminded me of Jewish Voice for Peace, but yeah.
Uh-huh. We're going to wrap soon. So if you could, you know, just moving now back to the overall picture, just please leave us with some final comments and then we'll wrap.
My final comment, and I come from a tradition where, especially if you were a quote unquote, you know, your basic work was in your mind and not with your hands or with a rifle, you're supposed to always end on a positive note. So my great friend, my dear mentor, Paul Sweezy, the greatest of American Marxist economists, he would always end with, but the forces of history and capitalism, it's inevitable that's going to be overthrown. And for people my age, I really needed to hear that. this positive view of the future. One of the things that separates our generation from everyone that preceded it, if you're on the left, is all preceding generations had absolute belief that history was on their side and that they would win. We would win. History was on our side. And the same thing even with Martin Luther King. The arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. You know, there's always, and our generation has, for good reason, lost the belief, the conviction that we have the force of history behind us. We have the force of justice behind us. Our generation or your generation, it believes there's a good chance we'll be defeated. There's a good chance we're not going to win. The only thing I can say is a conclusion is you never know. You see, you don't know. You can know one thing for certain. If you do nothing, it can only get worse. If you do nothing, it can only get worse because that greed on the other side is insatiable. The moment that Kamala Harris was nominated, immediately the billionaire class said, what are you going to do with capital gains? You have to reduce the taxes on capital gains. Always the greed. They don't have enough money. They never have enough. So if you don't fight, if you don't resist, if you are passive, it can only get worse. And if you resist, there are moments where it looks very grim. And then there's that folk song, it's always darkest before the dawn. It's this hope that keeps me carrying on. It's always darkest before the dawn. And I look at the examples, you know, if you go to 1860, right? Frederick Douglass writes an essay and he says, it's hopeless. We tried what was called back then moral suasion, convincing people of the wrongness of slavery. We spoke here, we rallied there, we put our lives on the line because a lot of people didn't want to hear that message about slavery being wrong. And he said, we lost. We have to accept it. And then the Civil War happens. Couldn't predict it. It was impossible to predict. The worst years of apartheid were emergency rule in the 1980s. It looked like apartheid had won. And you can name a thousand examples where it's darkest before the dawn. So I'm not going to say, as they said in the past, when Rosa Luxemburg is in jail and World War One happens, which was totally shattering for that generation. You know the expression, they call that generation that passed through World War One, they call it the lost generation, because they were so shattered by the vast destruction of European civilization, okay? And she's sitting in jail, and she always says, I find hope in the subterranean forces at work, namely history is on our side. We may not see it, but it's the subterranean, the forces below the surface that are at work, and they're on our side. We don't have that. We don't have that faith that subterranean forces are at work, but there's still the knowledge that you really don't know what will come next. But what you can say with certainty is, if you do nothing, not only nothing will happen, it'll get worse. It'll get worse. So that's my final message. I'm not going to say history is on our side, because I'm not convinced of it, and I don't believe I will convince anyone else in the face of reality. What I would say is, it's worth the try that we might win. It's worth the effort. And there's another reality. There's something in the human constitution that simply can't do nothing.
Yes.
In the face of such death and devastation. You just can't. I don't watch it. I don't look at it. I know it's there. I don't want to see it. I block it all out. And I just do my work. I don't want to see it. I know it's there. But in the face of knowing it's there, to just go on as if nothing is happening, I think that the whole human constitution rebels against that. So it's not really a choice. Last word, when the Spanish Civil War happened, Paul Robeson, who you can inform your listeners after I leave, he went to perform for the troops on the front line during the Spanish Civil War. And he made a famous line, and it's engraved on his tombstone. It said, an artist must elect to fight for freedom or for slavery. I have made my decision. I had no choice. I've always liked that line because it embodies my spirit. I have made my decision, as if he had a choice, as if it were his will. Semicolon, I had no choice. Well, if you had no choice, then you didn't make a decision. And that's sort of been my whole life. On the one hand, I chose to do what I did. Theoretically, I could have become a banker. But even as theoretically, it was an act of will. It was a choice. I know that in light of what my parents endured during World War II, I had no choice. It wasn't a decision I made. It wasn't an act of will, a decision. I had no choice. So, speaking personally, when I said the human constitution rebels at doing nothing in the face of such death and destruction, I think most normal people will say, you know what, maybe I should go to that demonstration or do something. All right. So nice to talk to Mr. Aaron and Ms. Katie, and
thank you, Norman. And on behalf of our audience, we're all very grateful for you. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.